This is tape number 15 of Goblinhood Satyricon, copyright 1995 by James Biotti, read by Goblinhood. This tape commences at the very end of the story in a section called The Revelation of Saint Gob of the Igor. The tape commences, to backtrack just a little bit, with chapter 14, verse 8, after the title character has just committed what some feel to be, quote, the greatest blunder of all time, unquote. 8. And many there were who believed then that Goblinhood had lost his head or had even taken leave of his very senses. 9. And some there were that were even capable of recognizing that this last was perfectly true. 10. But unanimous were all in proclaiming that this wasn't saying very much. 11. For it was said that the gob's senses weren't much to begin with. 12. But it was even well known, on the other hand, that things could always get worse. And in the confusion of the moment, when stern decisions had to be made by the Supreme Warlord, get worse, things most surely did. Chapter 15. 1. And the great blunder of the gob came about in this way, that he did consult his own fears in an effort to beef up the scary aspect of his own troops. 2. And lo, it was still the case that, of his fears, arachnophobia was still one of the strongest and most persistent. 3. And behold, he was even persuaded that spiders had about them some sort of top-notch survival qualities, for lo, had they not been around for millions of years. 4. And in this wise did he attempt to reason, though his thoughts on this subject are revealed as the veriest gibberish upon any close examination. 5. For only a mad fool would be able to delude himself that a bunch of mere spiders could be scary enough to make the host of Yawa take fright and run away. 6. And yet, this is what the gob, in his madness, did say unto himself. I will make of my followers a bunch of spiders, and these will be more than scary enough that the members of the mighty host of mine enemy shalt surely take fright and run away. 7. But still and all was there this much to be said for the mad gob, that even in pursuit of this his asinine scheme, did he yearn not to cause any harm to anybody or to anything. 8. And thus it could be said, and very arguably so, that it was actually Saint Gob who went looking for the most harmless means of effecting the, perhaps ill-advised, spiderization of the citizenry of Sodom at this time. 9. And in his own memory went he looking, and he found him that which did seem to have great significance upon his cause. 10. And it was this, that in a bygone time, whilst he was sodomizing a black widow named Bella Madonna, she did seem to actually turn into a black widow spider of gigantic size. 11. Nor did he neglect to remember that this event took place following the first hit of ichor that ever drank he, which was doubtless the cause of the anomaly. 12. And he did see that this was good, for he had no wish to have to butt fuck everyone in Sodom to achieve his aim, and especially not right now, when they all had an impending fight on their hands. Chapter 16. 1. And Saint Gob did look, and did behold him the bold advance, in virtual slow motion due to the dregs of the collapsing gaze of Yahweh's bold host in its rampant bloodlust. 2. And seeing this, did Saint Gob take fright, and, using his special, extraordinary wartime powers, did conjure up unto him the largest hit of ichor, and a mug to hold it in, that he did think himself to be capable of swallowing. 3. And then did he psionically magnify its potency by a factor of 1 Googleplex, the largest number that he could recall, thinking him unto himself that this would surely be enough. 4. And then did he quaff unto him this super ichor, yea, verily, did he even chug the stuff. 5. And then went it to work upon him almost immediately. 6. And he looked him down from his high perch atop the ivory tower of his own building, and then did he behold him a most amazing sight, or seem to behold it. 7. And the revelation of Saint Gob of the ichor was this, that all his followers were now spiders, and of every manner of spider were they. 8. And he beheld him a Pinkovsky spider, and a Barbarossa spider, and 2 elephant spiders, and 1 skeletal elephant spider, and, furriest and feistiest of them all, a Shogun squirrel spider, wearing a tiny detective hat, and with a long and luxuriantly fluffy tail a wave behind. 9. And he did behold him Bella Madonna, most puissant of the black widow cultists, who did scream telepathically unto him, God damn it, you stupid bastard! What the fuck do you think you're doing? 10. And then did she collapse into a whole stack of actual black widow spiders. 11. And Saint Gob did then behold him Mandragora in her golden tarantula mask, who did kindly think unto him via telepathy, oh well, that's all right, at least you meant well. 12. And then she did collapse, very surprisingly, into a stack of golden tarantula spiders, probably because of the mask she was wearing, or perhaps because she was more like unto a golden tarantula than a black widow at heart. Chapter 17. 1. And it was doubtless the hope of Saint Gob that most of his followers, for martial reasons, would now have become truly dangerous spiders, such as black widow spiders and brown recluse spiders, and indeed quite a few of them were now these. 2. But alas, the vast majority of them turned out to have now become, for some absurd reason, exotic Sumatran bird shit spiders, which were of little or no strategic or tactical military value whatever in a fracas like unto the present one. 3. And strangest of all did Saint Gob, in his super ichor induced madness, behold him a vast number of purely imaginary spiders between his forces and those of Yahweh. 4. And when the Yahwan forces did reach these spiders, imaginary only unto their creator, Saint Gob, it was then seen that the Yahwan forces took not any fright, nor did they undertake to run away. 5. Instead did these indomitable forces of Yahweh stride boldly forth among the imaginary spiders, and did hold there a terrible muster, wreaking there a havoc most frightful to behold. 6. And the forces of Yahweh did laugh gleefully as they squished and bestrode the fully functional but imaginary spiders, yea, and they trod a good many into very paste. 7. And then did Saint Gob finally recognize his error in thinking that spiders would do any good, and he did cry aloud, "Woe is me, for I have fucked up royally, and as surely as I sit atop this tower, I feel that we are surely doomed." 8. And many there were among his followers, who in like wise were heard to cry in spidery little voices, "Yea, woe are we, for we are surely doomed." 9. And some there were among his followers who were heard to cry, "Behold, Saint Gob, for thou hast fucked up royally, and now, thanks be unto you, we are surely doomed." 10. And some did cry, "This is another nice mess thou hast gotten us into, you stupid bastard, for we are surely doomed." 11. And from some came the exclamation, "Way to go, you fool, we are doomed." 12. And this did certainly seem to be much upon the minds of all his followers, who had thus been spiderized all in vain. Chapter 18. 1. And the forces of Yahweh did then come ever onward, squishing and bestriding countless imaginary spiders in their wake, laughing all the while. And it must have been only that old Yahwan magic which had kept his forces from being spiderized too. 2. And the forces of St. Gob did then cry out unto their supreme warlord, as with one voice, saying, Smooth move, Ex-Lac, say magnifique, mais ce n'est pas la guerre. In fact, it's not even magnificent, and it sure as hell isn't war. 3. And St. Gob spoke unto them, saying in a smallish sort of voice, Come on now, can a guy even make one little mistake? 4. Nay, they all cried in unison, at least not a mistake of this magnitude and of such dire consequences. 5. And they told him then, as in one voice, Look you, we're all spiders now, and if you don't fix this, we'll all just scuttle on up there to where you are and scare you to death before Yahweh's laughing hyenas and toadies can even get here. 6. And this was taken by St. Gob to be a serious matter, which could portend no good and surely no idle threat. 7. And so it was that St. Gob undertook to bethink himself of some effort that would in no wise inspire the Yahwan forces to indulge themselves in fits of laughter and mirth. 8. And then it was that he remembered unto himself his youthful experiments with apostasy and his partial conversion unto the Lovecraft mythos. 9. And it came to him there, trapped between hammer and anvil, that this belief of yore could now be of military value. 10. Nor did he fail to determine then that he would use him, this secret weapon, whether it was harmless or not, things having now come to such a pretty pass. 11. And so did he prepare him then to inject the use of this extreme measure into the current fiasco, consequences be what they might. 12. And it came to him that he could then hear Lovecraft spinning in his grave. Chapter 19. 1. Then did St. Gob say unto himself, I'm only doing what others have done before me, particularly Lovecraft's posthumous collaborator, August Derleth, in books like unto The Lurker at the Threshold. And St. Gob did go so far as to add to this saying additional pronouncements such as, I'm only following orders, his own, and I'm only grasping at straws, the last straw rather, and even, I'm only the postman. 2. That said, however, still he was not loath to invoke the Lovecraft gods as a last resort. 3. And invoke those gods and entities he then did to the tune of a loud spinning heard as if from far away. 4. And very scary indeed were the great old ones and outer gods who appeared one by one at his invocation in a rapidly growing mob of giants between his tower and the approaching Yahwan horde. 5. And Azathoth was there, that mad nuclear chaos, and his co-ruler, Yog-Sothoth, the all, the one in all and all in one. 6. And even the very gate was Yog-Sothoth, through which came the others, from whatever inaccessible dimension they normally held sway over. 7. And then came Shub-Niggurath, the black goat of the woods with 1,000 young, and with her came her young. 8. And then came Nyarlathotep, that mocking messenger, and came he as a titan blur, and as a hell wind with black wings, and as a three-lobed burning eye. 9. And then came Cthulhu, that most puissant, tendril-faced lord, from his sunken tomb in lost Rillia. 10. And then came Ithaqua, the fearsome Wendigo, from the frigid climes of the frozen wastes, and came he with stars for his eyes. 11. And there came also then many others, among them Nodens and Neogtha, and ye Nightgaunts, and ye Ghasts, and ye Shoggoths, and ye Shantax, and Shudmel, and Sathagwa, and ye Ghouls, and ye Gugs, and ye Golanak, and Yig, and ye Dolls, and ye Migo, and ye Hounds of Tyndalos, and ye great race of Yith, and Hastur the Unspeakable, and ye Loigor, and ye Moon Beasts, and ye gods of ye outer spheres, and ye Old Ones from ye Mountains of Madness, and Gatanathoa, and ye Bogies, and ye Hobgoblins, and ye Deep Ones, and Father Dagon, and Mother Hydra, and Ran Tigoth, and ye Dimensional Shamblers, and ye Bugbears, and ye Things That Should Not Be, and Nurgle, ye Martian Zoni, and ye Like. And 'twas then to be seen that among them Nurgle did leer very oddly at St. Gob, as if chuckling at some secret mirth. 12. But one came who was in confusion, in that she was at a loss to know wherefore she had been disturbed, for she was Atlak Naka, great spider goddess, whom some called Mother of All, and who spun eternally some great web in a dimension of her own. And some said that the web was all time and space, all where and all when. Chapter 20. 1. And now did St. Gob discover that the very presence of great Cthulhu and company did serve to further erode the dregs of harmlessness, thus hastening the enemy's relentless approach. 2. But at least the spiders of St. Gob, once a threat unto him, did now gravitate unto Atlak Naka, thinking her a better savior than St. Gob had turned out to be. 3. Nor was this far short of the fact. 4. For behold, mistaking them for her own spawn, she did then welcome them unto her and did claim them for her own. 5. And clambering aboard her, they did all then wallow astride her in all her vast immensity, like unto so many baby wolf spiders with their mother, smirking up there astride her and awaiting further developments. 6. And meanwhile, behold, the rest of the Lovecraftian host was even now being summarily banished away again by unpleasantly erudite Yawin zombies who had once been doddering old librarians and the like. Typical Lovecraftian protagonist types, in short. 7. And yea, though St. Gob was among them all, the most unpleasantly erudite, still was it of no use unto him. 8. For lo, he had squandered him all his resources. Yea, verily, he had taken him his best shot, and had monumentally blown it. 9. And now did Yawa call out unto St. Gob, saying, I'm coming for you, oathbreaker, vile upstart. Ye shall surely be now impaled 10 times over upon 10 ivory towers of that same ilk. And then, while yet ye live, I will make of thy 10 throbbing assholes 10 new keyholes for mine pearly gates, and will have thy living guts for garters. All this whilst I consider how to really punish thee. 10. And now did St. Gob tremble in fear at Yahweh's wrath, as he came finally unto the very bottom of his pathetic bag of tricks. 11. And now did Atlak Naka open unto her a gateway, a mystic trap door leading unto her arachnid dimension, there to resume her eternal spinning among those grateful refugee newcomers. 12. And now did Alpha Omega, perhaps in keeping with his much vaunted sense of mercy, reach St. Gob's ivory tower before the even more bloodthirsty Yawa could get there, and, looming above it, did swing his giant two-edged sword that was his tongue, and did slice off the head of St. Gob, which did then fall unto the ground, still thinking, in that bloody instant, well, at least it's over now. Chapter 21. 1. But behold, it wasn't over now. 2. For lo, as St. Gob's decapitated, still living head landed with a thump upon the bloody stump of his neck, he could then feel 4 spiny, chitinous, hairy legs growing, yea, springing, from each side of his skull. 3. And even so could he now hear the magical arachnid dimension calling unto him and beckoning him unto a greater life than he had ever known, or so it seemed to his now spiderized senses. 4. And so it was then that, feeling not unlike the little crippled kid at the end of the Pied Piper, St. Spider Gob did then begin frantically scuttling after his people, the spider folk, as they disappeared through the mystic trap door into the wonder and glory of the arachnid dimension, there to dwell in harmony with the Great Mother forever, or at least for as long as possible, and in as much harmony as was possible among spiders. 5. And lo, did Yawa now become even more outraged and fit to be tied at having somehow been de-pantsed now by the retreating Shogun Squirrel Spider, which had somehow contrived this little stunt as a kind of parting shot. And did Yawa now scream at the lot of them, shaking his mighty fist and frothing, "You bastards will never get away with this. You've only given me access to the arachnid dimension, and there shall ye be dealt with most harshly." And saying this, did Yawa then prepare to follow. 6. And then did Saint Spider Gob see that this was so, and behold, still had he enough on the ball to want to discharge him his responsibilities and to take him care of any outstanding business here before escaping to elsewhere. 7. For lo, he had long since come to understand and to finally recognize, with the telepathic help of Ikor, that he himself had created this bogus dimension of Sodom, this flimsy excuse for a parallel universe, created it with his own mind, had he, psionically, simply by believing strongly enough in it. And then had he caused himself to forget about doing that in order to live here untroubled by pressing responsibility behind his own back, as it were, a fact long known but kept secret by many I-Corps members who regarded him as one of their own and had thus kept his secret somehow even from any Black Widows who weren't in I-Corps, yea, even from him. Nor did they fail to keep this secret from the Shogun Squirrel, regarded by some as one of their own, but also widely regarded as one with a big mouth, a secretive bunch, that I-Corps. But now was the secret out, thanks be unto the extraordinary wartime power of universal telepathy, created this place he had, out of desperation and the need for shelter, for a place where he could fit in and mean something, for a place to call home. 8. And knew he now that when he left this place, it would have no longer any name and no further purpose. This he reflected sadly upon, thinking of all the squished imaginary spiders all over the place around him, and realizing that even Yawa's mad raiders would doubtless now pursue a juicier destination, for had not Yawa even said so? 9. But this was goodbye to Sodom, and Saint Spider Gob wanted to make unto himself a fitting exit. 10. And lo, it can be said that Yawa was even now pulling his pants up and girding up his loins for mortal combat with Saint Spider Gob, a much anticipated battle royal in the offing. 11. But behold, it was with the reflex of one trained by the Terran energy depression of the late 20th century that Saint Spider Gob did gesture psionically and did thus cancel the sun and the stars of that continuum, like unto one turning off the lights before leaving a room. 12. And it was then, whilst riding a strand of spider web through the mystic trap door just before it slammed shut forever, and thinking at last, harmlessness be damned, that Saint Spider Gob did collapse the great darkness behind him before Yawa could even scream. Postscript. By Goblinhood, the reader of this tape. But I don't know exactly what to say. Following this novel, Beatty thought about making it into a trilogy, but unlike The Lord of the Rings, it wasn't exactly written to be that. And most trilogies, if you simply try to like cobble up further adventures into some sort of like, you know, connected story, they don't seem to do very well. The library shelves are groaning beneath, you know, 100-volume farragos of nonsense that start with somebody wanting to make even more money by turning whatever they wrote into a trilogy. There does sort of exist, though, a so-called Goblinhood trilogy consisting of Goblinhood Satyricon, so far unpublished, the more or less published piece, Goblinhood's Comics and Poems, which is available right now at the Acme Art Company, and a hopefully soon to be published piece entitled Libby's Monument, which would make it even more of a trilogy if that had certain other pieces with it, such as something called Steel Bob and Monstrella. But those are all like, they're more or less either short stories or little essays. So you can see that all three volumes would be different. This thing, Goblin and Satyricon, would come to like, I don't know, quite, you know, maybe almost 500 pages in a paperback, whereas the Goblinhood's Comics and Poems is only about, I don't know, 60 pages at most, and it's mostly comics and so forth. Libby's Monument is 82 typewritten pages, and if the other essays were added to it, it would come to over 100 pages, but they'd all be different. One would be mostly comics, one would be this novel, and one would be a collection of essays. They would all have one thing in common, which would be presenting a sort of history of Goblinhood, even though from different approaches. So, originally, Beatty was, you know, going to turn this into a trilogy. He even wrote sort of like, I don't know, I guess you could call them outlines for a couple more novels like this one. One called Goblinhood Agonistes and one called Goblinhood Furioso. And I'm not saying those will never get written, but, you know, the outlines really didn't come to very much in his mind, and he kind of wanted to leave this thing pristine. He didn't want to mess with this little set of myths or legends or whatever you would call it. But you can see how all three titles would have sort of like connected with each other. As for the real trilogy, the comic and, you know, this and Libby's Monument, because the other stuff is sort of like additional information that wouldn't really have to be there. There's one thing that it says in Libby's Monument about Goblinhood crying that directly contradicts something in here, in Goblinhood Satyricon. And I'd like to take this opportunity, this unpublished opportunity, to state that, you know, it's just an anomaly among many in this novel. And maybe this wasn't the real Goblinhood, or maybe this was an alternate Goblinhood, or, you know, maybe what Goblinhood said in Libby's Monument wasn't exactly true because he was dreaming at the time, or something like that. Anyway, I'm just kind of using up this side of tape. There's another thing that I guess I'll put on the other side, which is from the comic book, actually, and could almost be regarded as a sort of a sequel or prequel or something to Goblinhood Satyricon, because it talks about Goblinhood Satyricon. Anyway, I don't know if I'll get to that or not. And I don't know if I'll actually put it on the other side of this or not. But right now, this has been what Poe would have called all sorts of a job. This actually represents exactly the second time that I've read the thing since it was typed 4 years ago. And it holds up pretty well. You know, there's all kinds of little mistakes, and I'm not even talking about typos. I'm talking about, oh, there are still certain anomalous kind of anachronisms involving the timing, revolving around the whole messy St. Cloud affair. But one thing that keeps striking me is that from the very second page or so, this thing's cast itself as a Lovecraftian story. And Lovecraft's story had so much to do with books that it fully justifies all of the books that wind up being pivotal plot elements here, such as the short story by Robert Silverberg and the short story by Larry Niven, and other books that come into play, mostly which are supposed to be explaining the whole alternate dimension concept or whatever it is. I guess it doesn't really hold up under close scrutiny, but that isn't necessarily the way you would read a novel anyway. Or at least as I conceive it, that's not the way to do it. It's more like I don't know, it's more like just, you know, read it and enjoy it, or don't read it, don't enjoy it, or whatever. I enjoyed this. I enjoy the characters. It's the most writing it, once I really got going, was probably the most fun I'd ever had. It was right after this that I finally got busy putting Goblinhood's comics and poems together into a publishable format. And it was right after that, as I was finishing the last page, that I developed the second episode of a really bad ulcer that I've ever had in my life. So, for me, that's about par for the course. I still enjoy this. I'm glad to have it on tape. Because of all the stuff that I've taped to listen to, I really think I could listen to this a lot. Maybe eventually I'll even make extra copies so that it won't wear out. And besides, who knows, if the book is ever published, this tape will be worth something to whoever such things mean anything to. You know, I probably won't be around then, but I don't know. Right now I'm just waiting for the end of this side. I don't know if the Piccalilli and Death Perception story will even fit on the other side, but the kind of thing that I don't want to start in the middle of a side, so I'm going to give it a try. This story is from Goblin Hood's Comics and Poems, copyright 1994 by James Biotti, read by Goblin Hood. A note just before the story states that it was written around 10:30 a.m., November 10th, 1994. Piccalilli and Death Perception in the Muffin Realm. Call me Goblin Hood. I know that isn't a very original opening line, but I'm not trying to be original. I'm only trying to tell a story. Yet this isn't just a story. It's the history of an actual dream. A guy once told me, after reading my book Nightmares for the Yesterday People, that I'd ruined a good story by admitting that it was based on a dream. But he was an asshole, and he was wrong besides. Because a story is only a story, while a dream is something that really happened. This one really happened about 30 minutes ago. And how could I ever explain the complicated process by which I came to get up and write this down after only 3 hours of sleep? These days I don't remember dreams very often, though I used to do this all the time. Well, I could explain it that way, I suppose. Or I could say that dreams are important envoys from the human subconscious, which may contain information of benefit to us all, and even to future generations. Yeah, right. In the end, I guess it all came down to my having a brand new package of writing paper on hand and a bunch of pencils, all of which I'd recently bought for a novel that I was writing but hadn't needed to use up. Simple as that, really. So call me Goblin Hood, the writer, for I'm a published author, you see, of sorts, anyway, and a famous explorer of the human subconscious, in a small way. About that novel now, it's called Goblin Hood Satyricon, and is in part about how I supposedly killed my mother when I was 10 or 11 years old, killed her with my mind by psionically engineering a car crash for her to die in, to put paid to an argument we'd been having. Essentially, I'd hated her to death. Accidentally, of course. And of course, this bothered me some. Actually, it had ruined my life, but who's counting? And I've kept trying to console myself about it by, for example, telling myself that I'd only done it once. But in matters of matricide, as a great poet once said, once is more than enough. Actually, I was that great poet, too, whose illustrated ravings are part of a comic book that I'm working on publishing right now, to be called Goblin Hood's Comics and Poems. And both that and the novel were part of my dream. I suppose the novel got in because I'd just done some revision on it for the first time in a month or more, right before I fell asleep. Meanwhile, don't you just hate it when a writer oh so smugly and greatly quotes him or herself like that? Don't you just hate me anyway for being a red-handed, bloody-minded, psionic matricide? You probably should, I guess. Otherwise, you might be even sicker than I am. And I know from sick, kids, let me tell you, I've made a whole career out of it, so I ought to know. But I'm just not so sure about dreams, those envoys now. I'm not exactly sure where they fit in. There are at least two schools of thought on the subject. The more established one, evidently a basis for Jungian psychology or something, holds that dreams are important envoys from the human subconscious, etc., and would no doubt heartily approve of my current writing activity. Oddly, I was just reading up on Carl Jung in connection with that novel revision, but never mind. I first encountered the second school of thought in a science magazine published circa 1983 or 1984. According to this theory, dreams should be ignored as the mind's way of cleaning itself out, sort of like flushing a toilet. Not a bad metaphor, either, for some of my dreams. Did I mention badly needing to piss when I woke up? I wonder how many dreams have been remembered and even written down just because somebody desperately had to piss. In the light of that second theory, this scenario seems sort of ironic and paradoxical, as if the mind were using the body to defeat the mind's own purposes, sending one to the toilet, as it were, to keep one from flushing the big toilet. In a way, not unlike a government collecting urine specimens for surveillance purposes, I guess. Anyway, you all know me by now, right? I'm Goblinhood, the writer, the poet, the cartoonist. My mind is a vast wasteland, and some would say a vast sewer as well. And that's also important for you to know if you want to understand this dream I'm trying to tell you about. Some people would actually call me Goblinhood the pornographer, and if you want to know what I think, well, it's sort of explained in the dream. But before we can truly begin our little safari into the wilds of the subconscious, I have to introduce you to yet another principal character in this dream, a gent by the name of Gritman. Gritman is actually another cartoon character, like me, who appears in the Goblinhood comic book. Gritman was created by me and another artist named David C. Green, but he's mostly Dave's character. According to David, Gritman has a tool belt or something and a partner, Elvira, the singing saw. So I guess you could say that Gritman is sort of a carpenter. And he's tall, kind of thin, with sort of redneck long hair and a beard. I never realized till just now, come to think of it, how Christ-like Gritman actually seems, but by golly, and me, I'm kind of short, kind of fat, and I have a face like a spider. Actually, it's a mask I wear when I'm being Goblinhood, with a Martian symbol for harmlessness on the forehead so that people don't mistake me for a bad or dangerous spider. But if Gritman stands in for Christ in this context, which he might, then who would I correspond to? Or, as Jung might have put it, what the Sam Hill do you think you're talking about, Goblinhood? Get back to the dream, okay? So let's do that. The Christmas season was almost upon us, and there I was at the Miracle Mall, along with hordes of frantic shoppers. I didn't know at first that Gritman was around, but he was around all right, probably shopping merrily away somewhere nearby. I wasn't shopping. I was Xeroxing stuff for my comic book, or for my novel, or for some damned thing, and I was having a pretty lousy time of it. You know how in dreams you sometimes just appear full-blown in the middle of something, complete with a history of what you've been doing so far? Kind of like the theory that the universe was only recently created by somebody, along with the illusion that it had been around for a long time. Well, this was like that. What was about to happen to me would be happening for the second time during this dream, or this trip to the dream mall, or whatever it was. And I was desperately hoping to just forget about both times for my own peace of mind. If I'd only known how much paper there was out here, let alone how many pencils. Anyway, this is what was happening. I was trying to get a woman who worked at the Xerox place to copy some stuff for me on a better machine than the self-service copiers they had. The stuff in question should have been illustration material for the comic book or the novel. Actually, it kept changing back and forth. And that might have been bad enough. But imagine my embarrassment and discomfiture when the stuff turned into raw, hardcore pornography in her hands. Rank photographs of women getting screwed in the ass, to be precise. And why is it, I wonder, that Frank Zappa, for instance, could write songs about such matters and be considered funny, while I just seem disgusting for even helplessly dreaming about such things? But then I guess Tipper Gore didn't think Zappa was so damned funny during the McCarthy hearings for the music industry that she and her buddies in Congress held in the late 1980s, proving, I guess, that some things just aren't funny, unless it's the Bible talking about God destroying a whole city for performing acts of sodomy. And even that's not funny, although it always seemed a little funny to me, or a little weird anyway, sort of on the extreme side, if you know what I mean. Meanwhile, this is what was really happening regarding that whole Xerox porn situation. Out here in real life, I'd actually had to worry about this. The novel, for instance, was based around a bunch of surreal life drawings which I'd derived from photos like that. In part, the story was about pornography. In fact, one character in the novel actually uses pornography as a sacramental communion host for his religion, which is based around a strange sort of miracle of transubstantiation, so that the porn involved becomes the equivalent of a communion wafer or even a plastic Jesus or Mary icon, arguably no less savory of a religious practice than the symbolic ritual cannibalism practiced with real communion wafers. Anyway, I'd wondered, while awake, if I could even get away with copying the drawings myself without being caught red-handed, branded a pornographer, and summarily kicked out of whatever Xerox place I was patronizing. In my dream, that had already happened once, and it was about to happen again. But at least this time, I got the copies made, for whatever good that did. They cost me $27, which is about what a really good porn magazine might cost, or so I've been told. No, forget that. I've already admitted drawing from such pictures, haven't I? And while we're on the subject, Kurt Vonnegut Jr. once defined pornography in the novel Breakfast of Champions more or less as being fantasies of an impossibly hospitable world, which would describe quite a few religious beliefs, including those of Christianity, whenever it isn't advocating genocide over sexual orientation or calling for the end of the world or whatever. At any rate, after I forked over the cash, the woman in my dream very politely told me that the store didn't want my business anymore. Actually, and as an alternative, the woman asked me to get one of the other employees in specific to deal with my junk in the future. But he was a surly prick who, out here in real life, had actually hassled me about something like this once, so that was no good. Anyway, though I could fully understand the woman's viewpoint, and felt, in fact, as though I'd inadvertently launched some repulsive new perversion, that of forcing women to Xerox pornography, the whole episode amounted to getting kicked out for porno delinquency again, and I could only be glad I'd had that $27 on me in this dream, or things could have gotten really sticky. About that time, Gritman showed up, apparently just so that I'd have someone to tell the whole exciting story to, or to whine at about the whole squalid incident, or whatever. And so I did both while we wandered around the mega mall, which by now had turned into a monolithic supermarket. I was kind of nervous and paranoid there about dragging all that porn around, afraid of being accused of theft and strip searched or something. But Gritman was his usual imperturbable, rustic, corny self with a homily for every occasion. It soon developed that we both had to piss. Wonder where that idea came from. So we made tracks for the men's room, conveniently located nearby, as is the case with lots of things in the dream world. When we got there, it was pretty crowded, but I was lucky enough to secure myself a urinal as someone left, while Gripman had to go stand in one of the stalls. Actually, there was a diminutive junior urinal right next to me, but of course, neither one of us was about to use that. In fact, nobody seemed to want to use it, preferring to wait in line instead. After we'd each tapped a kidney, something happened that was the weirdest thing about Gripman in his dream. Perhaps one of the weirdest things ever, in fact, about anyone in any context, or so it seemed at the time. Weird as hell, anyway. As we were leaving the public restroom, I noticed a kind of vanity table in a corner. That, of course, was weird enough, but on closer inspection, it turned out to be a layout table of some sort, covered with mat knives, jars of rubber cement, and a big plastic bag of what Gripman called pick-a-lily. That wasn't what Gripman actually called it. He used some dream word that I can't remember in reference to this stuff. But it amounted to about the same thing, or seemed to, anyway. Gripman knew all about it, you see, because it turned out that this work table was his official headquarters whenever he happened to be in this restroom, or in this dream, or whatever. I couldn't make head nor tail of it. Gripman's so-called pick-a-lily was a bizarre hodgepodge or potpourri of assorted wood chips, dried leaves and flowers, trail mix with nuts and little pretzels, etc., and words cut out of magazines, as if by someone sending random notes circa the 1950s or whenever. It didn't seem to make any kind of sense. As if by someone sending ransom notes circa the 1950s or whenever. It didn't seem to make any kind of sense. In fact, I had to wonder, even in my dream, just what the fuck was Gripman doing with this stuff anyway. I didn't like the looks of it. But apparently it was some kind of a delicacy or something, because Gripman offered me some of the pick-a-lily to eat, taking a big handful for himself. But I had to decline because it reminded me too much of the crap left over in real life from my collage illustrations for my rabbit tobacco poem in the comic book. And it looked just about as tasteful. Anyway, speaking of pick-a-lily, my mother used to make this stuff and can it. She did a lot of canning before I canned her. She canned, or put up, real pick-a-lily, of course, not the idiotic Gripman variety that my pal was so exuberantly snarfing down, or whatever it was, in this weird dream can of so many years later. Real pick-a-lily was a loathsome concoction of pickles, peppers, and hell, Martians, for all I knew. It was supposed to be a relish, though I'd never been able to relish even the thought of it. But perhaps it was Gripman's relish for his own ridiculous version of it that made me invite him home to dinner, which I must have done because he was still hanging around at the dream's climax. And we were almost there already, courtesy of the Dreamland Travel Bureau. The Monster Mall was gone now, and we were approaching my home. But we bypassed not only distance, but time itself, because this was my childhood home, the house I grew up in, where I lived until right after my mother died, or until after she simply journeyed at high speed or terminal velocity through a windshield, like Alice through the looking glass, euphemistically speaking. This was a little farmhouse near Lodi, Ohio. One generally approached it down a steep hill and over a railroad trestle bridge, which scared hell out of me as a kid, instilling a permanent case of acrophobia and causing numerous nightmares of its own. But in my current dream, the bridge had been replaced by something else. Not that I noticed any change. At the time, I thought it had always been this way. Instead of crossing the good old time-honored trestle bridge, we approached the house somehow through the attic of that same house. a place where I'd spent many happy and sometimes scary hours looking at the corners, at the covers of my father's vast collection of vintage science fiction magazines. An interesting juxtaposition or transposition. I'd always associated the railroad bridge with my father, who worked for the railroad. In real life, half of this attic had been forbidden territory because it had no floor, only rafters over the ceiling below with a few boards across them like bridges. And now we had to cross something like this expanse to get to our destination. Okay, I'll admit, it probably wasn't really the attic of old. I don't know where we really were. Hell, I don't know where we are right now. Do you? Really? The way it looked, in any case, was that there was another room or a pit or something beneath these boards, some 15 or 20 feet below. A fair drop, it seemed. And it was pretty precarious. As Gritman traversed a board ahead of me, it snapped behind him and, oddly, just disappeared, leaving me stranded across this terrible gulf, an island of consciousness in a sea of perplexity, trapped on the wrong side. At first I didn't know what the hell to do, but then the usual dream logic came to my rescue. I remembered an apartment I'd lived in years ago, or years in the future from the perspective of this dream's current time, an apartment which was entered by a fire escape from the outside. Then, for the sake of convenience, I just assumed that the two places were connected, as if all houses just naturally were. So I thought I'd just backtrack a little, swing by the other side of the house, and enter through the fire escape entrance instead of the attic one. So it was really no problem. I was about to yell the particulars of this breezy and asinine little plan across the chasm to Gritman, who was just standing over there, probably wishing that Elvira was along so's he could fix this here floor. But just then something really strange happened. A door opened behind me, and two people came in carrying collapsible furniture of some kind, all folded up. One had a bed, the other carried a portable sofa, and it suddenly came to me intuitively that the furniture was meant to replace stuff which had burned up in a fire. But the fire had never happened except in the past of this dream. The person carrying the collapsed sofa was a woman. She approached the gaping pit, and I started begging her out of sympathetic acrophobia not to try crossing it. But she just laughed at me and stepped right out onto empty space. And then I received the shock of my life as I realized something that I'd never even remotely suspected. The space down there was only a clever Trompe l'Oeil picture painted on a solid floor just beneath some rafters covered with rotting boards. I was flabbergasted. This seemed to be a profound and really stupendous revelation about life itself. And now everyone was laughing at me, even Gritman, as I warily minced my way across the delusive solid floor, good-naturedly laughing at myself, though still amazed. And nobody was laughing harder than the sofa woman, whom I now perceived to be, was it possible, my supposedly dead mother? This new revelation catapulted me to the very pinnacle of hilarious, hysterical rapture and joy as I fell into her arms, laughing and weeping. She didn't look much like my mother, it's true. She looked more like Igor in a low-budget Frankenstein flick, complete with really cheesy, overdone makeup appliances. Her oversized head was bald and misshapen and covered with weird warts or some kind of, with weird scars or some kind of warts, or could it be buttery, oven-fresh crumbs? Yes, by Jove, though she was fungoid and rubbery, more than anything else, she looked for all the world like a big muffin. but I didn't care. I knew who she was, the way one knows something, the way one knows things, ex cathedra, in a dream. And she was alive. I'd never snuffed her after all, and I could finally say all the things that I'd always wanted and needed to say to her ever since that terrible apocalyptic day in my youth, as I cackled and sobbed and kissed her warty, crumbly scalp. God damn, Mommy, you really blew my mind, I gibbered, holding on to her for everything I was worth. But did I mean about the floor just now? Or about her tragic death way back when? Or what? And it occurred to me to wonder, a minute or so later on my way to the bathroom, whether mind-blowing had originated in the swinging 60s as a kind of veiled sexual reference. Anyway, I left it at that. I left it like that, with me slobbering all over her, and Gritman standing thanklessly around in the background. And I woke up to some of the brightest sunlight that I've ever known, frantically needing to piss, with the words of an actual song by good old Frank Zappa and the Mothers of Invention floating through my still dazzled mind. It was the one about the Muffin Man. There's a little postscript here from Goblinhood. In the 1997 revised edition of Goblinhood's Comics and Poems, which was only revised in the sense of giving it a new cover and a two-page introduction or preface, there's a correction about this story that I just read, complete with all the mistakes that I made in it. And the correction is this. In the short story Piccalilli and Death Perception in the Muffin Realm, I misquoted Kurt Vonnegut Jr., whose quote actually appears in the novel God Bless You, Mr. Rosewater. Okay, so much for the correction. You can see from this one story, which comes at the end of Goblinhood's Comics and Poems and is only even, you know, vaguely illustrated. But you can see from this that this would function as part of the so-called Goblinhood trilogy because it mentions the novel Goblinhood Satyricon, and it even throws in some kind of, like, you know, apocryphal data concerning the novel, which was, at the time this dream took place and this story was written, the novel only existed as a manuscript. It hadn't even been typed yet. Well, you know, okay, and then in Libby's Monument, the comic book is referenced two or three times, whereas the novel gets exactly one reference, which is that something to the effect that Beatty was not above cribbing stuff from a book by Robert Heinlein for his work, most notably the novel Goblinhood Satyricon. Okay. Anyway. I don't know. I don't really know what else to say here, except to say that in terms of, like, trying to make this whole thing into a trilogy, you know, like I've already, like, on the other side of this tape, I've already kind of snotted off a little bit about people who pursue whatever their stories were with endless sequels just because it's marketable. Okay, you know, and, like, that's cool because at least it helps promote literacy or something. But I'm thinking in artistic terms here. The outlines for the other two books in the so-called trilogy were extremely labored. One thing, having to like tie up all the loose ends and bring in all the same characters and so forth and so on, really cramps the artistic impulse to no end, you know. And so I can see why that kind of stuff must be really like work to the people who write it, you know. The volume 18 of the vampire unicorn dragon swordsman series, blah blah. Well, I'm not going to do that. Like I said, the other two books, Goblinhood Agonistes and Goblinhood Furioso, I won't say they'll never get written, but I will say that the outlines really weren't that good. And the few sample chapters I have of whichever one was first isn't even good enough to like for me to have read it. I mean, it just, I don't know what I was trying to do, but probably so different aspects of goblinhood in the three different things. Well, this does. Goblinhood's comics and poems so far is the public version of goblinhood, and it's as public as things can get. So far, the Goblinhood Satyricon, the novel, it's kind of the esoteric version. And I do hope to be doing something with Libby's Monument, a dream tale of goblinhood, because that's even more public. That was like written specifically for the public, and it's kind of like the nice version of goblinhood, as opposed to the version in Goblinhood's comics and poems, which, as you can tell from that story, attempts to be nice as it can be, but that isn't always that easy. As for Goblinhood Satyricon, I haven't even tried to do anything with it. There exists one other copy that a friend of mine has, because he sort of figured in the novel as the character Desmond Garm, because I was trying for that chapter to be written as closely as possible to, you know, a realistic effort, or at least a different kind of style than the rest of the novel was using. And in that context, you know, the one reason I'm sitting on the novel is less because of the sexual material than it is because of all the stuff about drug addiction. It's just not the kind of stuff one wants to pop off about in the middle of a drug war, which is still going on and will probably always be going on here. And the novel speaks for itself on that subject. And the trouble is that these things change so much. Like, there used to be something called decriminalization involving certain substances, and that changed when Reagan came to power and launched an actual drug war, so-called. And so these things fluctuate, and even though the whole St. Cloud episode of that type, you know, in that sense, was long, long ago and was only something to be studied for the novel or whatever, still it's not something I'd really like want to go public with, you know. Although I don't know that, you know, I was reading the novel, this is the second time I've read it, I think I said that, since it got typed. And it doesn't seem as bad as I thought it would be as a novel. It mostly holds together if you're just trying to read it out of interest in what it says. One difference between that and its two proposed sequels is that they had virtually nothing to say. It had all been said in Goblin Head Satyricon, and so they were basically just the worst kind of sequels, which is to just take the characters and play around with them to amuse your readers. I've never been very good at making up fiction. The novel is probably as close as I'll ever come. But yes, of course, it was all fiction. Any resemblance to anything at all is strictly coincidental. Maybe I should throw that in. Maybe I should also mention the date right now. It's the 18th of March. No, the 18th of April, 1999. It's a Sunday. I took pains to finish reading Satyricon before Sunday came along, for superstitious reasons. And right now it's 12:48 a.m. So you can see from that how good of a job I did taking those alleged pains. For once, I'm probably going to like turn around and listen to all 15 tapes in a row. This will be the first thing I've actually listened to since I started taping these things. Because this is my story, Goblin Head Satyricon. I mean, all the other stuff, they're just there for me to listen to while I work, and so is this. But on the other hand, this is the author reading his own story, and someday, in a posthumous kind of sense, it might actually be worth something to people to have, you know, the story read on tape by the guy that wrote it, or rather by the character that it's about. And besides, I kind of like it. Of all the tapes I've got, this one is the one most likely to be. This series of tapes are the tapes most likely to be reproduced by me and, you know, kept in order to have like extra copies and so forth, because so far, I mean, I can't say for sure, but I have the feeling that even though it takes almost 24 hours to listen to all 15 tapes, I may wind up doing that more than once, because I do kind of like it. I kind of like the idea of like the character Goblinhood being all squared away like that, and everything being like settled once and for all in this mythical little realm that he's created for himself. It's all very pat, it's all very tidy, and some of the novel I think is well written, and some of it, I don't know, it's probably ridiculous. But most of it, I can say this, yeah, it was fiction, and I may have got some facts incorrect, like some of the stuff about the Donner Party right now strikes me as possibly being spurious, you know, even though it was quoted by memory from something that I'd actually read in a real text on the subject, an encyclopedia of crime stories or something, in a section devoted to cannibalism. But, you know, okay, so it's all fiction, blah, 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 any resemblances, etc., etc. And I was trying to make a point, although it also goes on to say probably many times in that section that, you know, Goblinhood seldom, if ever, knew what the hell he was talking about, etc., unquote, or whatever. You'll have to forgive me here. I'm just a little bit giddy. This taping job is the longest I've ever undertaken, and probably the longest I ever will. Just like the typing job was the longest that I'd ever done at the time. And the idea of sitting here listening to all 15 tapes in a row is kind of weird, but at least, you know, I'm free to like roll cigarettes or something and look at the triptych while I do it. And I haven't really had a chance to do that all month. Look at the triptych, that is. So maybe it's worthwhile. I'll probably be reading Libby's Monument onto tape before too long. I've still got a few tapes left. And there's a couple of other things. But, you know, this is basically it. This was my big magnum opus, both when I wrote it and when I typed it, and now when I've taped it. And it's precisely the kind of thing that, you know, I would want on tape to listen to while I'm working on the triptych. I don't know if I'll actually be doing that, but then I don't even know if there will be a tomorrow. I don't know if the universe itself will endure. I don't think any of us really knows that, and it's one of the things that Goblin Hood Satyricon is so interested in, even though so unknowledgeable about. But I can't say this. It seems like a strange time right now, because you don't undertake something like this lightly. The tapes are there, just like the novel is there, and I don't think I'm going to be destroying them, because I'm never going to be able to forget how much work I put into this little project. But I think the most important thing for me to listen to is that whole rigmarole about St. Cloud and about his ideas concerning freedom of expression, because that's why the novel exists. That's why any of this exists, and that's why that's basically the same stuff the story Steel Bob and Monstrella, already on tape, is talking about. You know, the fact that this stuff exists. You can burn it, you can burn me, you can do whatever you want, but I'm not going to be ashamed of it, because I meant well, or I meant something. In any case, I meant it when I was doing it, and I guess I still mean it, because I just got done spending 3 days taping it. And now it's Sunday, now it's my day of rest, now I get to just sit back and finally get something to eat, hopefully to help get rid of this headache I've got right now, and just go ahead and listen to Goblin Hood Satyricon. I'll be the first person ever to get to listen to it. But given the importance of the project, that should be part of it. It'll be the third time I've read the thing, actually, you know, by listening to it. And that should be part of it, because out of 15 tapes, it wouldn't be too surprising if one of them was defective or something and had to be dubbed onto another tape or even done over again, which I would kind of want to know about as soon as possible. I don't think I'll be listening to it often enough to get the tapes eaten or anything, but I will be test driving it now, partly because right now, at the end of this 3 days, I really can't imagine doing anything else. I've got all these other tapes I could listen to, but none of them mean anything to me. I could listen to music while I read a book or something, but there's really only one book right now that I'd actually feel like reading. And you know what that is, I guess. And I'm going to be listening to it instead, which sort of precludes the idea of listening to music at the same time. So anyway, all of you out there, if anybody listening to this, should wish me luck as I prepare to monitor my activities of the last 3 days and to see how they did. At least one tape in the course of this actually did start to get eaten, and so it didn't get used for the taping. I may have screwed it up when I put it into the taping machine, but on the other hand, I choose to look at it as a kind of a virgin sacrifice, you know, in order to pave the way for the rest of the work to get done well enough. So I have to listen to all 15 tapes now and hope that none of them gets eaten or anything, because if they do, then they'll have to get done over again, and it's kind of a dismal prospect. But I can console myself that I still do have lots of tapes if I have to do it over again. I still do have enough to do half the book over again if I wanted to. More than half. And I've even still got something else really spectacular to put on tape in a couple of days, and that would be Libby's Monument, which the next time I read that, I think, is probably going to be out loud. And after which, after all this, I don't know if I'll be reading anything else on tape, because I really have other things I should be doing, so this may be it, or Libby's Monument, probably.